tonight to share his experience granting hope, we have Chris F.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. It's really great to be here. I want to thank Sean for tracking me down and asking me to come out here. Looks like a really great group. On or around December 28th, 1989, I had my separation experience from alcohol. It was my alcoholism had progressed to such a point at this time that I went into the DTs. I would have really violent reactions to stopping drinking when I was on one of these benders. And so I'm not really positive about the day. I know it was in between Christmas and New Year's, 1989. And I had that separation experience. I think we all have experiences where we separate from alcohol. Some of us get to the grace of God that allows us to stay separated, and some of us don't. Sometimes it's the fault of us if we've heard the message and we choose to reject it, or we understand the process of recovery and we choose to not engage in it. But unfortunately, more often than not, it's another couple of reasons. If you're new, if you're just coming back, or if you have not gone through the steps yet, there's two things about you that are very, very true that you're not going to believe. One of them is you're in way more trouble than you think you are. Way more trouble. Alcoholism does not allow you the dignity of being able to accurately assess just how much trouble you're in. It doesn't. The second thing that's true is that Alcoholics Anonymous has a more substantial answer to the problem that you have than you think it does. I know this because I work with a lot of newcomers. I also know it from personal experience. Alcohol was killing me. And I said to myself back in 1989, I think I need to go to AA now to stop drinking. I thought that there was a chance. I wasn't sure, but I thought there was a chance if I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll be able to stop drinking. My life was basically a living hell at this point in time. And all I was really hoping for was to separate from alcohol. I thought if I could just do that, I'd be okay. I had no idea how all-encompassing alcoholism really is. And I certainly didn't understand the gifts, the potential gifts and potential promises of a recovery program in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know it. Didn't understand it. Now, there's a lot of things that all of us have in common. As alcoholics, there's things that we're just different than other people. We metabolize alcohol differently, and there's a lot of personality traits that we have that are similar. I share this story that I'm about to share quite often, and a lot of people come up to me after the meeting and say, that happened to me, it happened just like this. I was doing a fear inventory, and the person who was instructing me to go through the inventory this time said, I want you to do something a little extra. I want you to identify the very first time that you experienced the fear that you're inventorying. And as I'm doing my inventory list, I come across fear of people. And I remember back, and the earliest recollection of fear of people was when I got dropped off for kindergarten. I remember my mother throwing me in the car, driving me to kindergarten, pulling up and saying, there it is. And I get out of the car and I'm standing up there on a hill looking down at the school and there's kids playing tag and kickball. They were already friends, it looked like, for their whole lives. And here I am standing up on the hill like, you know, feeling like a jerk because I'm feeling really uncomfortable. What if I go down there and they do, you know, they don't accept me, or they don't like me, or they make fun of me, or, you know, I embarrass myself. I had all this self-centered fear, all these emotions about what people would think about me and everything. And, you know, and looking down at these kids weren't thinking that. They were just having a blast. So I'm telling you, you know what would have helped me? Give me a pint of vodka and I would have been able to handle kindergarten like you wouldn't believe. I'll tell you, I'd have been the kindergarten kid. You know what I mean? I would have. And that was my problem. I was born a pint short. Does anybody understand what I'm saying? Did you ever have to get some booze just to be able to step out? Because you just didn't feel comfortable stepping out. So you get yourself like a half a pint in you for ballast. You get drunk before you go to the party to get drunk. You know what I mean? There's something fundamentally wrong with us. Emotionally and spiritually, we are not like our fellows. Now, so here's my problem. My problem is all this self-centered fear. My problem is all this emotional uncomfortability that I have. You know, I'm uncomfortable with myself. I'm uncomfortable with my environment. And from age 5 on, I had to act as if everything was okay. I had to act as if I wasn't afraid of you. I had to act as if what you said to me didn't bother me. I had to hide all these feelings. I had to act cool. I had to act as if. And it was a burden. It was hard. It was a lot of work. And I never felt right. I'm cutting school with a couple of my buddies one day. I'm about 12 or 13. We decide to go back to my house and take down a bottle of booze and get drunk. It's the first time I ever did this. First time they ever did this. So here we are. I don't know anything about drinking except the old John Wayne movies. You know, he busts through the saloon doors, "Bartender, whiskey!" And a bartender will pour a dirty water glass filled with whiskey. He'll shoot the whole thing down, grab the bottle, go back to the table, and, you know, wait around until he has to shoot somebody. You know, so I don't know anything about drinking. You know, I don't come from a household of hard drinkers. There was, you know, a couple people that drank beer. That was about it. So anyway, I pour out these big water glasses of whiskey. And the two guys that I drank with never became problem drinkers, never became alcoholics. They just didn't. Here's how they drank. They had 2/3 of their glass, and they had enough. And they were able to say, "No more for me. I've had enough." You ever drink with people like that? Is that the worst? You know, you're like, "I've got to go home to the little wifey." What? Let's go to the city! It's only 1 o'clock! We'll be back for you to go to work at 5! I mean, I never understood the word enough. You know what I mean? Anybody in here that used cocaine to propel their drinking, little father? Did you ever like buy an apple and say, I'll leave the rest for tomorrow? Sure you will. What you'll do is you'll go to work the next day, you'll grit your teeth like this. Everybody will be looking at you. That's what you'll do. Because we're different. We're different. We have an obsession of the mind which gets us to that substance. And we have an allergy to the body that keeps us continuing to use it. It's not a good prognosis. But what happened to me when I was drinking was a lot different than those two buddies who had 2/3 of a glass. I started drinking, and about 2/3 of a glass down, I started to feel okay. That fear, that self-centered Chris crap that I had started to disappear. And it was like, you know, I know everybody in here will understand. Sometimes this even happens before you put the alcohol to your lips. You remember, you remember that feeling? Well, that's how I felt two-thirds of the way through this class, and all of a sudden, I could step out. I didn't care what you thought about me. I felt like I was the funniest, coolest person on the planet. Nothing bothered me. I was reborn. I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. You know what I mean? Another wish to shut the door on the past. I found that I could be a benefit to others. If you were a brain surgeon, I could give you advice at the bar, you know? Well, what kind of scalpel you use, you know? I'm serious. I found that inner peace. And then I got unbelievably sick, learned about projectile vomiting and blackouts. Anybody in here a blackout drinker? That's disconcerting, isn't it? You don't even know if you have any I nevers if you're a blackout drinker. You know what I mean? So, I was a blackout drinker. I mean, you know, I would come to in some amazing places, you know what I mean? It was like, it was scary sometimes. Well, you know, what am I doing here? Because I'd travel, you know, in a blackout. And then you have to pretend you want to be there because you don't want anybody to think you're stupid. You know, what the hell am I doing here? You're like, no, you got to act like you're meant to be there. You know, Topeka, walking around with one shoe or something, you know? But that alcohol, from the moment I felt that sense of ease and comfort, I started to become preoccupied with alcohol. Where was I going to drink it? Who was I going to drink it with? I was 12 and the drinking age was 21. So, you know, there was some logistics that would have to be worked out, you know. But I was, you know, I would persevere. I mean, we did what we needed to do. You know, some of the crap we ended up drinking was pretty bad, too. But anyway, I started to become preoccupied with alcohol. And, you know, I'm going to skip the whole war story. I'm going to tell you my last drink, okay? My last drink, I'd been through rehab. I had signed myself into rehab. And I had found that not drinking and going to meetings, for me, was not a treatment for alcoholism. What it did was it created a finite space of time where I didn't put alcohol in my body. But all the craziness and all the self-centered fear and the depression and the anxiety and the guilt and the remorse and everything was still all over me. I just wasn't drinking. That's a grim outlook, you know. But I had signed myself in. Alcohol was really getting my attention. I'd lost my family. I'd had 3 DWIs. I'd totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts. Because I come from a place where you let friends drive drunk. You know what I mean? Friends let friends drive drunk. And I went through the front windshield one time, the passenger windshield. I even woke up on the trunk of my car one time, like glass in my hair. And, I, you know, it's a Toyota. It's still running. There's not a window left in it. 3 flat tires. It's bent like a boomerang. The drive shaft is slapping the frame. I got glass in my hair. I climb back into this thing, and I start driving. Okay? Because I'm going home. Where are you going? Home. The cops pull me over doing radar. I'm doing like a mile and a half an hour. Why got a boogie in a van? Why got a boogie in a van? Like cops pull me over. He goes, where'd you have that accident? You know, I'm like, what accident, officer? He goes, where are you going? I'm like, Baskin Ranch. He goes, that's 28 miles. Are you nuts? Cops were always bugging me, you know? They was always after me, hassling me. Just leave me alone. Going home. You know, so I mean, it was horrible. The things that were happening to me, I'm 33 years old when I get sober, and I'm living at home with Mom. You know, because my family fell apart. I wasn't really that employable. And I figured one day, Mom needs some help around the house, you know. And so I moved back there. I burnt her house down twice. Drinking by accident, you know. Yeah, she needed me around the house like she needed a hole in it. But I've got a 1976 Ford Granada with white walls and, you know, no clutch and no muffler and no emergency brakes and no heater. It's like January because I was busy. You know, when you drink, you drink. You don't have a lot of time for, like, working on the car. So I had this piece of crap. You know, and I'm living at home with Mom, and I've got no money. It's just absolutely a nightmare. Finally, it's Christmas, okay? My brother and sister come home, nieces and nephews, cats. I mean, you know, the Christmas tree was up with, and the stockings were hung by the chimney with care, and, you know, the carols were on the stereo, and I start drinking. And I had a special Christmas drink. I don't know about anybody else in here. Mine was Johnny Walker Black Label for the holidays. And I start drinking this stuff, and I go into a violent blackout rage where I threaten my entire family with a 38 caliber handgun. Now, this wasn't the festive mood they were looking for. You know what I mean? Somebody gonna kill them. You know? They've all come home for, like, you know, family and all these things that you don't understand when you're an alcoholic, but all this warm, fuzzy stuff. I want to kill people. So they all picked up and they moved their whole Christmas up to upstate New York. And I come out of this blackout and, you know, I'm like staggering around, and I mean, this was the worst one I'd ever had. I go into the kitchen and I find a pile of vodka bottles this high. I don't even remember buying them. And I used to buy one bottle at a time. Any smokers in here that buy one pack at a time because you might quit? That's the way I was. I don't want to be stuck with a lot of overhead. So I must have staggered uptown to buy this vodka, you know. Oh, that must have been a sight, you know, walking serpentine, you know, through town trying to get my vodka. But anyway, I start to go into this detox, the DTs. I start to hallucinate and go into convulsions, and, you know, I'm calling on the phone, and I'm trying to figure out what happened, where is everybody, you know, my presents are gone, you know. I mean, trying to figure out what the hell's going on. And, you know, I figured out, and I remember asking my family to come home because I didn't want to die alone. I mean, I'm going through some serious detoxing. My aorta is pumping like a garden hose, you know what I mean? I really think my ticket is going to get punched, and I didn't want to die alone. And I'm asking my family, please come back home. And you know what they said? No, we don't want to have to see you die. That was the right thing to do. There's nothing worse for an alcoholic. There's nothing worse. The only thing worse than bad luck for an alcoholic is good luck. What I mean by that is, if we win the lottery, it'll kill us. If we know all the cops in town and they always let us off, it'll kill us. If we've got an understanding family that gives us a steak and a bed, you know, after we've going through one more run, it'll kill us. And them saying, no, you've got to do this yourself, was a defining moment for me. I didn't sleep or eat and just could barely get down a little bit of water for like 3 or 4 days during this detox. And it finally got to a point where I need to go to a meeting. I knew that I needed to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't really fully understand why. Because I gotta tell you, my first stint in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't really get the picture. Okay, I remember explaining to one of my electrician buddies what AA was like, because, you know, I'd gone to some meetings. He goes, well, what's it all like there in that A&A? And I said, well, you know, you walk in and, you know, you get a cup of coffee and you sit down and they say the Serenity Prayer. And then somebody will start the meeting and somebody will raise their hand and say they've got a resentment. And then some other people will raise their hand and say, I had a resentment too. And this is my resentment. This was like my resentment. And then at the end, everybody will get up and hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. And he was as confused as I was about just what the hell is that? Does that do? You know? I go, it's only a dollar. You know?
understand why it was working. You know, what is it? It was hard to convince me that doing that was the answer to my problems. I have real problems. I've got real, I don't know about your problems, but my problems are real. I've got big problems. I'm different than you. Not a run-of-the-mill alcoholic. I'm special. Anybody ever think about that? I may be a scumbag, but I'm not a run-of-the-mill scumbag. I'm a special scumbag. So I don't know. I don't know why it works. I don't know why it works. So after I relapse, get this. I'm going to AA. I'm doing two meetings a week. I'm doing two outpatients a week where I pay $35 to hear somebody share about their stuff. You know, you sit in group and then share, and usually what happened to me this week, you know. It's just my wife just doesn't understand me. It's like a bad Bob Newhart episode, you know. I'm paying $35 to hear some moron tell me about his life I could care less about. I'm hoping he drinks so he doesn't come back the next week. I'm going to AA. You know, I'm not drinking. I'm telling everybody I'm not drinking. I mean, what more do you want? I'm on my way to an AA meeting, and the thought crosses my mind. This is what the thought said to me. Now, I gotta tell you, after this happened to me, I understood the obsession of the mind. Absolutely, experientially. Because here's what my mind told me. Chris, this sobriety stuff is really, really great. But you know what you should do? You should buy a gallon of vodka and drink it. And here's why, before you overreact, here's why. You're not really getting into this AA thing. You're not one of the guys in AA. If you got drunk, it would make you feel so bad that you'd rush back to AA and you'd just integrate and you'd really do a good job. And besides, you can't even remember what it's like to be drunk. You're sober almost 90 days, for God's sake. And somebody said, if you can't remember your last drunk, you probably haven't had it. You know. So I buy the gallon of vodka. And I go back home and I start drinking it. Now, it says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, the guy that was pounding the bar, asking him, how could this have happened again? That's exactly what happened to me. Drink number three woke me up and I recognized the enormity of my mistake. Okay? An enormous mistake. I've opened the cage door to the beast, and he's going to drag me around by the ass as long as he wants to. Because I've got no power and no control once I start drinking, where it's going to take me or how long I'm going to be on the ride. I just don't. And I realize I've made a huge mistake. Now, let me ask you this. Where was I insane? When I was drinking or when I wasn't? The alcohol restored me to sanity. The insane part of this, the most insane thing I did was convince myself to put the booze back in my body. I even had to convince myself it would be good for my sobriety to drink. One of the reasons you get a sponsor. You know what I mean? Anybody in here sponsoring you? Newcomers come up to you and they've got a plan. You know, aren't some of them beauts? You know what I mean? Oh, God. And if you're new and you've got a plan and you're in here, grab one of us and tell us the plan before you do it. Jesus. You know, we can save you a lot of trouble. Anyway, so that's how I relapsed. Now, I come back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've got to tell you, I've got a willingness born of desperation. I almost died in this last shot, and I'm kind of fond of being alive. And I almost killed my entire family with a handgun. And there's times I'm even, fond of some of my family. You know, that scared that crap out of me. I've got to do, because I'm one of these guys that don't really want to end up in prison. So anyway, I come back into AA and I make a commitment. I make a fellowship commitment. What they told me to do back then was go to meetings. My sponsor, Grammy, says, Chris, I want you to meeting every night until I tell you to stop. I started listening to fellowship suggestions. As a matter of fact, there were periods of time where I went from anywhere from 8 to 14 meetings a week.
I was a treasurer over here. I was a coffee maker over here. I was a secretary over here. I was a no-show GSR at this meeting. I'd go out to the diner, you know, with people afterward. I'd buy people who didn't have any money, you know, lunch. I mean, I was hanging out with the AAs. I was going to the sober dances. Oh! Don't do that until you have a couple of years. Please! Oh! It's brutal. It brought back a very traumatic experience for me. Remember I told you I was like the real repressed, real self-centered fear kid? Well, back when we were like 9 and 10 years old, they had this thing called barn dancing in school, where they would line all the women up on one side of the gym and all the men, all the girls and all the boys on the other side of the gym. They'd blow the whistle and you'd have to run across the gym and grab a girl to dance with. You know, I'd still wake up having cold sweats over that one. You know, all they were doing was making psychiatrists rich doing crazy shit like that. And my God. Here I am, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm struggling. That scared kindergartner that I was telling you about, he's still all over me. He's a sober scared kindergartner, you know? I mean, I've got nothing now to dull the pain of me. And it's really a grim time. Now, I had this buddy of mine, Radio Shack Mike. Everybody had nicknames back then, you know, and because I was nicknaming them really pretty much, you know. I was always good for that. And he had tapes. He would listen to tapes, and he talked me into a tape one time, and it was an affirmation tape. He should not have given this to me, but he gave it to me. And one part of the thing is it tells you to get in front of a mirror and repeat these affirmations. And I remember standing in front of the mirror going, Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're bullshit! I'm a scumbag! I know it! It's like throw the tape out the window. Now, I'm an alcoholic. I've got alcoholism. Trying to treat alcoholism with affirmations is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb. All right? You're going to a gunfight with a butter knife. It's not going to work. So I threw the tape away. You know, so the next time he gives me these tapes, I'm thinking, you know, not some more tapes, you know. And I go, well, who is this? So it's a couple of guys from Arkansas. I'm like, Arkansas? Arkansas? Are you crazy? We do more thinking before 9 o'clock than somebody in Arkansas does all day. The hell are they going to teach me? Arkansas. I had contempt prior to investigation. Anyway, so I start, I've got a long ride to work, so I throw the thing in, and I start listening. And it was, God bless him, it was Joe and Charlie. Many of you in here are experienced with Joe and Charlie. Unbelievable introduction to the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Very, 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 very good for someone who's not experienced with that. Anyway, I start listening to it, and I'm prone to resentments at that time. Can you imagine? Anybody in here relate? You get a resentment? I mean, I had resentments against like 90% of the people in my home group. I mean, when I was new, I didn't like anybody. They're a bunch of hypocrites. Listen to that guy share. Oh, God. If he shares one more time about being a grateful alcoholic, I'm slashing his tires. I'll see how grateful he is with four flats. That's me. Anyway, I'm driving down the road, and I'm listening to these Joe and Charlie. And here's what they tell me. I hear this loud and clear. Now, picture me being real happy to hear this. Chris, you do not have a program, an AA program. What you have is a bunch of fellowship activity. Nice. That's very nice. But You need the program of recovery to be able to recover. The program is found in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're not going through the book Alcoholics Anonymous and following the suggestions and spiritual exercises, you do not have an AA program, because that's what an AA program is. So don't tell people that you're working a program, because you're not. And when you come back or when you go back out, don't tell anybody that AA didn't work, because you didn't work AA. Now, I'm going to 14 meetings a week. I'm driving the boobies from the hatch from to the meetings. You know, I'm even sponsoring people at this time, you know, and some of them are even still alive. You know, sometimes the tugboat with the most steam, you know, gets the tow jobs. And I gave good share, you know. I learned right off how to give good share in meetings, you know. How to not make anybody mad and make just the right amount of people like what I say and all that crap that you do as an alcoholic seeking approval. I could care less today about approval, believe it or not. But anyway, so... I'm mad at these tapes now, because there's a part in the book Alcoholics Anonymous in the chapter Working with Others where it says if you've disturbed them about their alcoholism, which is step one, you have an obsession of the mind that will, not can, will bring you back to alcohol no matter what. There's nothing you personally can do about it. You're going to drink again. Once you start drinking, you have a phenomenon of craving that's going to continue to ensure your body kills itself through the craving of alcohol. And dash, your life has become unmanageable, meaning that you're suffering from depression, anxiety, self-centered fear, guilt, remorse, resentment, all those things that just make life worth living. You know? That's what understanding alcoholism is. That's what understanding alcoholism is. So, they taught me this. I'm pissed off about it because it's inconvenient truth. You know what I mean? It means now I'm going to have to take responsibility for something. It's no longer an outside issue. It's an inside job. And I recognize that, and it's not good news for me. So I throw these tapes, you know, down in the back seat or whatever, you know. But what happened was, it was wonderful to be awakened to this knowledge, because what it did was it brought me to my own experience. Some things went on in my life over the following months where I was denying the necessity of working a program that led me back to my knees. I had what's known as a sober bottom. I think a lot of us have been there. If you don't work the steps and you stay sober any period of time, you're going to go there yourself, and you're either going to drink or you're going to have a sober bottom and recommit yourself to this process. I was able to do that because these tapes told me how. If I didn't have that message, when I hit that sober bottom, I would have drank. It would have been the only way to stop the emotional pain. You know, I know what alcohol does. I know it destroys me, but I also know that between drink 6 and drink 8, I feel some euphoria, you know? And sometimes you just grasp for that. You just, you know? So what I did was I opened up the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this is 1992, middle of New Jersey. Nobody is working a big book program at all in any of the meetings that I'm at. It's unheard of. Nobody had heard of these tapes. Everybody was going to discussion meetings where you discuss. Everybody here knows what they're like, right? I can't, you know, I hope that person shuts up so I can raise my hand because I want to discuss. I've got some discussions to do too. I want to talk. And there were discussion meetings, and there were speaker meetings, and there were step meetings where people talked about the steps, philosophized about the steps, read about the steps, thought about the steps, but never did them. Amen. You'd hear a ninth step meeting where somebody would go, well, I haven't got to this step formally, but I'd like to take this meeting hostage for 8 minutes and share about my opinion on what this step might be like if I actually ever took it. You know,
Oh, can you be my sponsor? I don't want to do the work either. Oh. So that's what there was. So here's what I did. I went to the book Alcoholics Anonymous on this side. Joe and Charlie takes here, pencil here, and me just as confused as you can be. Imagine, you know. But I'm trying. I'm doing the four column inventories, and I even went back to make amends. I did amends cards. I went back and I made amends to ex bosses, to ex wives, to old friends. Houses that I trashed. I started to do this because Joe and Charlie told me to. And I went back and I started to make amends. And something very peculiar happened. You know that scared, repressed kindergartner that was always inside of me? All of a sudden, I started to be able to step out easy. All of a sudden, the fear started to leave me. And I started to feel some comfort and some serenity in my life. Now, before you engage in a spiritual process, you're only going to have an opinion on it. There's two types of knowledge. One type of knowledge is intellectual knowledge. One type of knowledge is experiential knowledge. I always use this as an example. There's two twin boys. They're about 5 years old. They get really interested in mountain climbing. All right. As they grow older, one of them starts going to every library they can, getting books, every book they can get on mountaineering. The other one starts going to Outward Bound and starts going to climbing school and actually learns how to climb. By the time he's 18, he's the youngest summiter to ever summit Mount Everest, where the other guy is ready to start teaching mountaineering in a college. Now, who do you want to talk to about what it's like to stand on top of Mount Everest? You want to talk to the person who's done it, not to the person who has the intellectual knowledge on it, to the person who had his ears freezing off standing there looking out into the Himalayas. Now, it's the same thing with recovery. We've all got opinions on what the steps are going to be like for us. We know. But you know what? We're wrong. Every one of us. It's always a little bit different, if not a lot different, than what we expected when we actually get through it. Here's one for you. The difference between having an unfinished amend or unfinished amends and having completed every single amends you're conscious of to the best of your ability is like the difference between night and day spiritually. It is. If there's anybody in here tonight that's hanging on to some amends, I beg you to make those amends so that you can find the level of freedom that's being offered in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not about relief. The early meetings that I went to in New Jersey was about relief from alcoholism. Don't drink, go to meetings, get relief from active alcoholism. But what Alcoholics Anonymous promises is freedom. Freedom is a lot better than relief. Okay, so pay very close attention to who you get as a sponsor, who you work through the steps with. Find somebody that's experienced. Find somebody that says, yes, you know, I have done my amends. Yes, I do pray and meditate every day. Yes, I work with others. I take people through the steps. Find somebody like that. This is your life. This is not only your life as far as you could drink again. This is your quality of life, too. Because one of the wonderful things in Alcoholics Anonymous is the recovery process of Alcoholics Anonymous has over 200 promises that are absolutely wonderful promises. Think about some of the promises in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you know any other progressively fatal illness that the treatment will bring about promises like that? You know what I mean? I doubt it. You know, cancer treatment does not promise a new freedom and a new happiness. And you know, it just doesn't. It promises you a renewed life. What Alcoholics Anonymous promises you is a reborn life. It's even better than before you started to drink, if you're anything like me. Now, in Alcoholics Anonymous at this time, like I said, I had just gone through the steps. I found out that I had started to taste a little bit of recovery rather than sobriety. You may call it semantics, but I believe sobriety is not putting alcohol in your body. You can still be the biggest prick on the face of the earth and be sober. Punch a cop and you can get sober real quick. But recovery is the whole persona recovers from an abnormal state of mind and body. We're so sick
when we first come in here, we don't even think we're sick. That's what I said earlier. You're in way more trouble than you think you are. For you to know how much trouble you're in, you have to get out of trouble so you can look back and say, my God, I was in trouble. Because when you're in it, you're like, oh, this is just the way it is. You know, I feel like putting a bullet in my head every minute, you know. What's new? I mean, I swear. Going through life was a toil, was drudgery to me. Today, I wish there was 1,000 hours in a day. I don't have enough time to do the things that I want to do. So anyway, I've recovered to a point. I've had a spiritual awakening. Now, the people that I was sponsoring were drinking on me. You ever have people drink on you when you work with them? Makes you look bad. You know what I mean? Somebody will come up and go, Chris, is Harry yours? Do you know he's drinking and he's stealing money out of the basket and he's hitting on all the women?
Yeah, Harry's mine.
Well, they were drinking on me and making me look bad. And so I started bringing them over to my house. And I go, hey, there's these tapes and, you know, there's this book. I'll go, why don't you just come over to my house? And I'd bring them over and we'd start reading through the book. I would read them every word in the book. And when it came to an instruction or a directive, stop. Let's do this, and then let's get back to the text. If it says, we listed the people we were angry, with whom we had had a resentment, we put it down in black and white, stop. After you've done that, we move on. Like you would any textbook. If you had a calculus textbook, would you read it through like a novel and get to the end and say, yeah, that calculus? I don't think so. I think you have to do the problems. You know what I mean? In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to take the exercises to get the results. Otherwise, you're going to be one of those people sharing in a meeting, well, I haven't done the 12 step officially, but I'm sponsoring all these people that I'm going to kill, you know, putting a notch on my big book for everybody that dies. So, you know, get yourself some experience with this stuff. So I start bringing these guys over and they start going through the book Alcoholics Anonymous with me. And I want to tell you something incredibly significant. Yes, there were people that got to the fourth and the fifth step and, wow, man, it's a little bit of an overreaction to a problem that I kind of overestimated. You know, I don't think I was really that bad. This is like kind of advanced stuff for me.
It's a list of people that you're mad at. Good God.
I bet if I go to your house, I'll find 35 self-help books that are more complicated than this. You know? And I bet I won't find one help others book. Selfish bastard. Anyway, so I get them over. Now, there was a few people who didn't make it through. But the people that did, the people that made it to the fifth step and then started making amends, learned how to pray and meditate, and then started to work with other people, every single one of them is still around. Every single one. They're card-carrying AA members in good standing, working with other people, every single one. Some of them had some, you know, relapses along the way because they rested on their laurels. If anybody wants to know what laurels is, where it says we rest on your laurels, you're in trouble. Laurels is yesterday's accomplishments. Now we do live a day at a time. We don't stop drinking a day at a time. You better want to stop drinking the rest of your life, or you ain't got no shot at doing this. Even if you want to stop drinking, it's hard to motivate up for that. But if you're just, you know, in here for a rest stop, you're in some deep crap. But we do have a spiritual condition that we need to maintain on a daily basis. We absolutely have to do that. So sometimes we fall short. Sometimes we just forget. Sometimes, have you ever seen people who kind of like drifted away from AA and then like 3 years, you haven't seen them in 3 years, all of a sudden they're back, oh!
I mean, duh. You're supposed to drink if you do that. Don't act surprised. It's not okay to leave AA. You know, we pat you on the ass and we tell you to keep coming back. You're the most important person in the room, but we don't believe it. We think you're a horse's ass. But keep coming, you know. Keep coming because we want somebody that makes us feel good about ourselves, you know. Anyway, stay here, all right? Stay here. It's not okay to leave. It's not okay to leave, all right? There's a lot of people that your lives affect when you relapse, for God's sake. You know what I mean? So anyway, I start taking people through the steps. All of a sudden, now there's a bunch of little people running around taking other people through the steps, and there's some people that are mad at me about it, you know? Who's this Chris guy? What's he doing? You know, who's he think he is? But, the book says to do it, you know? You'll like me better if I fail? God, what's the matter with you? It became like politically correct to be a moron somewhere along the line in AA and to not pay attention. You know,
yeah, I heard about the steps. I don't choose to do them.
You're in a 12-step program. You're not going to do the steps? You know, if you were suffering from pancreas cancer and they had like a 12-step procedure, if you said, yeah, I know about that 12-step procedure, but I'm just not going to buy, they'd call the loony bin. They'd lock you up. You'd go to the flight deck. But what happens in AA? People come in, well, you know, I don't think I'm really ready for the steps. I don't know. They call it the work. I don't know. We should be calling the flight deck on these people. You're dying. I'll tell you right now, you're dying and you don't even know it. And alcoholism is so bad, it kills people that don't even have it. We crash cars into families, we burn houses down, we do stupid things like pull guns on our family. It's an illness that kills people that don't even have it. It's so bad. And we check out with absolutely no dignity at all. 90% of the people with alcoholism die an alcoholic death, and the people closest to them either pity them or can't stand them. All right? You go out and there's nobody there. I have buried a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. The people that go out drinking, there's three guys there. It makes for a tough time carrying the casket with only three guys. You know what I mean? The people that go out who are strong AA members, I've seen 500-600 people at their funeral. How do you want to check out? How do you want your life to read? How do you want this? Do you want the scales balanced? Because if you're alcoholic, you've harmed people, you've harmed your family. Don't you want to balance the scales? Because if you're alcoholic, I've never met an evil alcoholic. We do evil things, but we're not evil people. We don't want to hurt people. We want to be a positive influence in people's lives. Alcoholism just doesn't allow us to do that because it just destroys so much of our being. That we can't. We become these self-centered, you know, arrogant, obnoxious, you know, people that, you know, retreat into their own little dark twilight zone type of existence. It's just a terrible way to live. So the recovery process brings us back out into the light, the sunlight of the spirit. You know, we need this. We're lucky to have had this. Without Bill and Bob putting the pieces of the puzzle together, we'd all still be dying, you know. So here, there's a couple of people running around the Burnsville Basking Ridge area with a spiritual awakening and pissing off everybody. And there was this one guy who had somebody that he was working with, and the guy was relapsing. And he sent him to me. He said, Chris, I don't know what to do with this guy. Whatever the hell you do, what you do with this guy? So this guy was a chronic relapser. You know, 8 years, just never get a month together. I take him through the steps. He has 93 amends. He ends up making over 90 of his 93 amends. The lights are now on in the attic. You see that with some people, right? They wake up, that spiritual awakening.
all of a sudden there's somebody home, you know. And his sponsor goes, God damn, what happened to this guy? So he comes to me and he goes, Chris, you know, this is a guy who had like 15 years. I had like 4 or 5 years at this time. He goes, whatever the hell you did with this guy, would you do it to me? Yeah. And I said, yeah, sure. Take him to the steps. Now, this was an individual who never had a real job. Never got his license back for multiple DWIs. Didn't want to pay the surcharge. Was in terrible relationships with women. Just completely irresponsible. You know, Grateful Dead t-shirts and going to the job interviews. You know what I mean? It's like just really over the top. And he wasn't going anywhere. Within a year, this guy had gotten a job, gotten his license back, gotten engaged to a woman, and, you know, started his own business, bought a house, like within a year. And the priest at his church noticed a little bit of a change and said, what the hell happened to you? He goes, oh, I went through the steps. Well, how'd you do that? Well, there's this guy, Chris. He goes, I want to meet Chris. This is the priest of this church. So he goes, well, I hear he's speaking up in Netcong on Tuesday. So this priest comes up, listens to me speak, in the back of the room, comes up to me after the meeting and goes, whatever you're doing over at your house, I want you to do it in my church. You can have any night of the week. I don't want any money. It needs to be part of my mission. I'll help you however I can. Now, this is 1997. There were step meetings. There were speaker meetings. And there were discussion meetings. There were not Chris Teaches You How to Recover meetings. You know what I mean? I knew I was going to get crap from everybody. I was going to start a meeting where I read out of the big book and tell you what it means. This is like heresy back in 1997. But I've had a spiritual awakening. A priest is asking me to do it. The pieces of the puzzle are falling into place. How can I say no? So I start the spiritual awakenings group. And I think 16 people came to the first meeting. And we had our ups and downs, but we can have anywhere from 40 to 100 people there on a Tuesday night now. And that particular meeting has affected much of recovery in the North Jersey area. A lot of meetings were started by people who came a long way to go to Burnersville, stayed for a little while, and then took that message back to their areas. And there's big book meetings that are really big book meetings now all over North Jersey. And I take the only credit I take for this is being a channel of God's message. I believe God got tired of seeing us all die. And then I believe he got tired of seeing us all suffer in AA meetings. You know what I mean? I'm just not drinking today. You know, I beat the crap out of my wife. I killed my dog, but I didn't take a drink. I think God got plenty tired of that, you know. And so now there's some big book meetings around. There's big book meetings. There's recovery. Listen, I am telling you, if you're new, if you're just coming back, or if you have not gone through the steps yet, you are in more trouble than you think. And there's a bigger answer in this room for all of your problems, even your special problems. Okay, there's more of an answer in here for those than you think. Again, I want to thank Sean for coming here. I've got some friends here tonight that have come out to see me. Mark and Bart, I want to thank them for coming, especially Rob, who took the ride in, and thank you all for being here tonight. Welcome if you got them.